massive car bomb exploded outside of a large federal building in downtown Oklahoma City, shattering that building, killing children, killing federal employees, military men, and civilians.
The chaos in downtown Oklahoma City did indeed resemble Beirut after what police believe to be a 1,200-pound car bomb ripped through the nine-story federal building shortly after 9 o'clock this morning.
If it seemed like war...
It's like a garbage pile. It's unbelievable. Everywhere you dig, you find somebody. Everywhere.
I found myself this morning looking back at things and thinking of things that I didn't really think about during the... During the thing, and tears still come to my eyes.
Seemed like war.
They're saying there's an 8-foot crater, and a couple of cars at least have been joined by the heat and the force of the explosion.
In Lebanon, a spokesman for the Iranian-backed Hezbollah said, "We are only interested in liberating our land from the Israeli occupation. We have no relation with the explosion inside the United States."
Our family, he didn't suffer.
There you see the farmhouse right now. This is where two individuals, we believe two, maybe more, were being sought.
Seemed like war.
That's a farmhouse said to be owned by two brothers with possible links to the bombing. They are identified as James Douglas Nichols and Terry Lynn Nichols. Law enforcement sources say those two men and McVeigh were expelled from a paramilitary group for being too radical. Officials are refusing to speculate on what motive any of these suspects might have.
He told me earlier this evening, having to do with experiments in bomb making and a passionate anger against the federal government for its actions against the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas 2 years back, is circumstantial but telling.
One suspect, according to our sources, is in custody now.
27-year-old Tim McVeigh, the crew cut John Doe number one in the FBI sketch, had been stopped for speeding in this Mercury Marquis, 60 miles north of Oklahoma City, about 90 minutes after the bombing.
Reno hinted at a wider conspiracy.
I remind everyone that John Doe number 2 remains at large. He should be considered armed and extremely dangerous. There is a strong likelihood that other persons are involved in this tragedy as well.
Seemed like war.
Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, best-selling author Ian Totten, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our eighth look at the Oklahoma City bombing and Timothy McVeigh. Now, before we get into the story, as always, I have the normal show notes and plugs. If you would like to follow me on social media, just search for Ian Totten, author, Corpse Creek Publishing, or The Deathcast. I am on most social media sites, so if you search any one of those terms out, you should find me. If you are interested in signing up for the show's mailing list, just go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com and click on the sign up button. I very rarely send anything out, but it is a way to get updates on what is happening with me, along with my novels and the show. While you're there, please consider making a donation to the show. Just click on the donate button. Buy me a cup of coffee or, you know, just let me know that you think I'm doing a good job. No amount is too little, and of course, no amount is too much. For those of you who have donated to the show in the past, it is greatly appreciated. If you really like what I'm doing, you can always go to tinyurl.com/DCPatreon and sign up to become a Patreon member. There are Patreon exclusive episodes up there now, and there will be more coming in the future. For as little as $2 a month, you can become a supporter of this show. Lastly, please consider going to your favorite podcast app, clicking on the subscribe button and leaving a 5-star review. Really does help get the show out to more people. For those of you who have given 5-star reviews, again, it is greatly appreciated. All right, this is the last episode of the Deathcast before the Christmas holidays. So for those of you who do celebrate, Merry Christmas. If you don't celebrate it, but you celebrate something else, I have a lot of Jewish friends out there who I know who listen to this show. Happy Hanukkah. For those of you who don't celebrate either of those particular holidays, just happy holidays. Enjoy the time off, stay safe, and don't do anything that's going to get you in the newspaper. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, get yourself something to drink. Find a nice comfy chair, kick back, relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, we had been talking about the Aryan Republican Army as well as the ties they had Timothy McVeigh. And in our McVeigh timeline, we got up to fall of 1994. We discussed how September 12th was seen as being the official day that the conspiracy to blow up the Alfred Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City was officially gotten underway. So this week, we're going to try and get chugging along with the McVeigh timeline leading up to and including the actual bombing. So, very quickly, on November 4th of 1994, Stephen Colburn, who, if you'll remember, was heavily suspected of possibly being part of the conspiracy to bomb the Murrah Building and is known to have had interactions with an individual whom he knew as Tim Tuttle. He quits his job at the DNA lab in California. And he did this from a location in Texarkana, Arkansas. Later, when questioned about this particular moment in time, Karen Anderson, who, if you'll remember, was the live-in girlfriend of one of the individuals who McVeigh knew from the gun show circuit, was asked to mail a letter for Colburn. And she told the FBI that she had been asked to do this and that the letter was actually for Colburn's girlfriend, as he did not want her to know his location. What's interesting at this point in time is the following day, November 5th, Roger Moore, if you'll remember, was an asset of the intelligence agencies, as well as a very big dealer in the gun show circuit slash white supremacist movement. He ended up getting robbed outside of his house. Moore said that he was robbed of between $9,000 and $24,000 in cash, precious metals and stones, a key to his safety deposit box, and 77 guns, which were valued at $66,000. Moore immediately went to his neighbor's house and told them what had happened. The neighbors became suspicious, however, when Moore informed them that he had not contacted the police because, as Moore put it, the government was responsible for the robbery, and they had committed the robbery in order to let him know that, A, he was under their surveillance, and B, to keep him in check. Eventually, these neighbors were able to convince Moore to contact the police. Fortunately for Moore, he was unable to produce any serial numbers for these weapons that were stolen. Also, interesting of note is the fact that Moore's van had been stolen during the course of this robbery. And according to Moore, both himself and Karen Anderson were the only individuals who actually knew what was inside of this van, which was a list of all the serial numbers for the guns that he had. Lo and behold, when this van was recovered a few hours later, this list had mysteriously vanished. When questioned further about the robbery, one of the individuals that Roger Moore told the police about was Timothy McVeigh. McVeigh, it should be pointed out, had been at a gun show in Ohio. But it is interesting that this robbery happens after he has pretty much demanded that Terry Nichols rob Moore under threat of something happening to Nichols' family. Later on, Nichols would claim that Moore was compliant in the robbery. That is to say, he was a part of it. as Moore figured he could probably get money from his insurance companies for the list of stolen weaponry. Nichols further went on to say that Moore had not only helped plan out the robbery, he had left the money that was to be stolen out on a desk and gone even further, giving Nichols an area where he could leave the van when it was over with. That evening, McVeigh called Michael Fortier and let him know that, quote-unquote, Terry did Bob, before warning Fortier that Roger Moore would probably send private investigators out trying to find out who had robbed him, and that Fortier should go underground. Interestingly enough, items belonging to Roger Moore ended up in a storage unit in Las Vegas that Terry Nichols is known to have rented. But not only that, other items that were the property of Moore also ended up in a storage shed that was owned by the Aryan Republican Army. This shed was in Ohio. The actual guns were given away and sold, as well as planted on people. Eventually, it would be discovered that the majority of the guns that had been taken had not even been registered. As with so many things in this story, there are various theories as to why Moore was actually robbed. Some have stated, particularly the federal government, that Moore was robbed in order to fund the coming bombing. Others have stated that Moore was actually robbed by members of the ARA without Nichols' foreknowledge, and that he only became aware of it after the fact. While still others have claimed that Moore set the entire thing up as an insurance scheme. Now, according to Terry Nichols, in 2005, he stated that McVeigh eventually told him that the robbery had been staged by both himself and Moore in an effort to shield Moore from what was going to happen. What was going to happen being the actual bombing, in order to keep him off of the police's radar. Also in November of 1994, at least according to an informant who was inside Elm City, she stated that both herself, Andreas Strassmeyer, and a man by the name of Dennis Mahon made the first of numerous trips to Oklahoma City, specifically to scout out the Mira building and figure out whether or not it was a suitable target for a terror attack. Later on, a man who ran a real estate office contacted the FBI. And this individual had training in naval intelligence, specifically in memory recall. This individual claimed that months before the bombing, an individual contacted him by the name of Tim concerning a lot that he had for sale in Oklahoma City. When the individual calling himself Tim arrived, he noticed, A, that he was with two other individuals, one of whom was named Nichols, the other who called himself Jax. This individual noted also that the man called Tim had a discolored tooth in his mouth, which he quickly realized was a filling. That is important, as later on the FBI would note when taking handwriting tests from McVeigh that he had a discolored tooth that matched the exact location and description as the tooth discussed by this real estate broker. Also, during this conversation with the individual known as Tim and his cohorts, it was discovered that there was something off about the three men. This broker realized that the three of them had some form of military training, and he became suspicious of them, so suspicious, in fact, that at least according to this individual, he showed one of them, who was known as Jax, a map and had him touch the map and point out different locations on him on this map. Afterwards, this individual took the map and locked it into a safe and eventually turned it over to the FBI. Another piece of information that came from this particular interaction with this mysterious Tim and his two friends is that other people who worked in the office also recalled seeing these individuals, as well as a vehicle that bore Arizona license plates. Why is that important? Well, as I discussed last episode, during this period of time, McVeigh was back in Kingman, Arizona, and was known to have been traveling throughout the country to various gun shows, but also was known to be in areas that the ARRA was known to have robbed banks during the period of times that they committed these robberies. You might be scratching your head trying to figure out who these two individuals are that were seen with this mysterious Tim, and we have some evidence as to the possible name of one of them. Shortly after McVeigh arrived in Kingman, Arizona, two other individuals, a 60-year-old man by the name of Robert Jax and a 35-year-old by the name of Gary Lan, also arrived in Kingman, renting a small mailbox in the same post office that McVeigh's mailbox was in. Also of interest is the fact that these two men closed their mailbox in August of that year, during the same week that McVeigh is known to have left town yet again. Further, it is known that the two men rented various hotel rooms from November of 1994 through April of 1995. These hotels were located either directly at hotels that McVeigh himself was staying at or near enough by that it can't be considered coincidence. They also rented a motel in Venetia, Oklahoma, on the day of the bombing, where it has been said McVeigh planned on taking refuge after the bombing was completed. Now, the evening of McVeigh's arrest, Lance and Jax checked into a different motel, this one in Perry, Oklahoma, staying there for only a few hours before checking out and going back to the hotel in Venetia. Both of these men had APBs put out for them on May 1st. They would eventually be arrested in Carthage, Missouri, about an hour away from the real estate agent's office. When talking about the arrest of the two men, an FBI agent told reporters, quote, "The trail of Mr. Land and Mr. Jack proved to be the strongest lead yet in the search for a suspect and for a wider circle of conspirators they believed to have been responsible for the explosion. Several officials said that they strongly suspect Mr. Land is John Doe number two." Later on, of course, numerous witnesses would come forward in both Kansas and Oklahoma claiming to have seen McVeigh in the presence of these two individuals. On May 3rd, both men were given polygraph tests and released unconditionally, with the FBI stating that their movements together with McVeigh were sheer coincidence. Also in November of 1994, Tim McVeigh's grandfather, Bill, passed away, and eventually his father was able to get in contact with him and inform him that his grandfather had passed away, at which point McVeigh is known to have immediately returned home to upstate New York, where he stayed for just a short period of time friends who saw him during this period of time noted that he had withered away and become a paranoid and delusional individual. From December of 1994 until early February of 1995, Timothy McVeigh bounced around the country from Ohio, Illinois, Kansas, and Michigan, Arizona, you name it. And it was said that during this period of time, he was in the process of gathering materials for the making of this bomb, while also offloading the guns that he had gotten from Roger Moore. While traveling to Michigan, it's known that McVeigh had mercury switches and blasting caps in the back of his car, wrapped up as Christmas presents. Now, McVeigh ended up getting into an accident of some sort on this trip, and it's notable that later, when the ARA was brought down, Christmas presents were found in one of their storage units, which were these mercury switches and blasting caps, and that the FBI had them immediately destroyed. It has been said that over the Christmas holiday, McVeigh got into an argument with Nichols, during which he let it slip that his handler was quote-unquote Larry Potts, who was a lead FBI agent at the Ruby Ridge Massacre, as well as the siege at Waco. According to Nichols, McVeigh was, quote, extremely angry and accused Potts of manipulating him and forcing him to go off script, which Nichols took to mean that the target and date of the bombing had been switched by someone higher up the chain of command from McVeigh. Nichols claimed at various points to never have actually known the target nor the date of the bombing was to take place. He also stated that Michael Fortier did, in fact, know this information. Whether this is true or not is really up to the listener to decide. From February to April of 1995, McVeigh was constantly in and out of Kingman, Arizona, staying at various hotels, and it was during these hotel stays that numerous people saw McVeigh, stating he was almost always dressed in fatigues, and that he had a constant stream of visitors to these hotel rooms. McVeigh also made various visits to different National Alliance meetings, at one of which he aroused the suspicions of the National Alliance members. This is probably because McVeigh had, by this point, given up any pretense that he was a, you know, straight-laced, normal individual and was constantly talking about his hatred for the government and of possibly overthrowing them. He's also known to have started visiting the Mura building. In fact, various people came forward after the bombing to state that they had seen McVeigh inside of the building at various points leading up to the actual bombing itself. It is thought and said by McVeigh that he was pretty much just scouting the area, trying to figure out where would be the best area to park the van in order to do the most damage possible. From March to April of 1995, McVeigh was seen in various areas, including in Kansas, usually in the presence of multiple individuals. If you believe the conspiracy theory about McVeigh, during this period of time, it's said that he received explosives training in Colorado before going on to Las Vegas, where it's said that he met up with his handler, the mysterious Major, and was instructed to keep in daily contact with him up until the time of the bombing. One train of thought has it that McVeigh checked into a hotel in Kingman, Arizona during March and stayed there until April 12th, leaving only to get food. However, multiple witnesses have come forward to state that McVeigh, while in fact in this room, had numerous guests visiting him during this time. Some people have even gone so far as to speculate that it was in fact some of these guests who were actually involved in the building of the truck bomb. From this hotel room, numerous phone calls have been found to have been made using a calling card that he had. Some of these calls went to a local National Alliance office, others to a local Ryder truck rental, and further calls to Elm City, and also to an organization known as the Cause Foundation, who offered legal defenses for individuals on the extreme right. On April 6th of 1995, an informant for the U.S. Marshal's Office by the name of Carrie Gagan contacted his handlers in Denver and informed them that he had just returned from a meeting in Kingman, Arizona, and had learned that a bombing was planned to occur within the next 2 weeks. A few months after the bombing, the FBI was contacted by an individual who stated that in the weeks leading up to the bombing, he was out in the deserts of Arizona where he heard and saw what he thought was a plane going down. Upon inspection, he discovered there were two individuals out there who did not appear to have any form of transportation. When he got to the site, however, the two men had vanished. Again, according to this individual, he figured they were probably hiding in nearby bushes, and it was only upon later retrospection that he realized the two individuals had probably been doing a test run of the bombing that was to take place in Oklahoma City. Another individual, this one a reporter for both the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, also contacted the FBI to give them information that he had learned, which is that before the bombing, McVeigh had met with a Cuban individual at a hideout or compound in the desert area around Kingman, and that this individual was known to have ties to various terrorist organizations in the Middle East. Why this is important is that the first individual who contacted the FBI concerned seeing the possible plane going down in the deserts outside of Kingman told the FBI that the area was littered with various hideouts for known white supremacists, survivalists, and National Alliance members. That individual also told the FBI that he had heard it through the grapevine that McVeigh was quote-unquote a good soldier and not a general. He also went on to state that he believed the individuals who had been directing McVeigh would eventually be found in Kingman, which, as we know now in hindsight, never took place. On April 17th of 1995, the phone calls coming from McVeigh's hotel room stopped before resuming again on April 11th. This is important because McVeigh, or individuals who either looked like or purporting themselves to be McVeigh, were seen at numerous locations all over the United States. These include at Michael Fortier's house in Kingman, Arizona, but are also include Colorado, Kansas, and Oklahoma. These individuals who made these claims all had one thing in common, and that is that they stated that the man whom they encountered made a very distinct point of letting them know that his name was McVeigh. before further stating that they needed to remember that name because they would be hearing it again very soon. Also during this period of time where he is supposed to have been in the hotel room but is seen in multiple areas, the sightings of McBay inside of the Murrah building really escalated. But it's also important to note that as these sightings of him escalated inside the Murrah building as well as in various places throughout the U.S., the amount of people he was seen with at a given time also began to increase. And it's thought by some, particularly those who believe there was a conspiracy involved in the bombing and the plot, that these individuals were members of this conspiracy. And well, though it might not have actually been McVeigh who they were seeing, they had gone out there in order to try and create a false trail of McVeigh in order to possibly throw off law enforcement's efforts to try and track him down. One of these individuals claiming to meet McVeigh actually went inside of the daycare center at the Murrah building, claiming that he and his children had just moved into the area and he was considering putting his kids inside of the daycare center. Now, instead of asking what would be considered normal questions about the center itself, this individual questioned the people running the daycare center about the security cameras inside of the building, along with the Murrah building's construction. This is important to note, as McVeigh contested up until the day that he died that he had never actually been inside of the Murrah building. Roughly 2 weeks prior to the building, employees who worked at the federal courthouse in downtown Oklahoma City, as well as at the Murrah building, were given notice that they needed to report any suspicious-looking individuals, and rumors began to circulate that the federal government may have had intelligence about a possible bombing plot at one of the federal buildings in Oklahoma City. This is of note, as the FBI has denied ever giving these instructions out. Although a man by the name of Harvey Weathers, who was a deputy chief of the Oklahoma City Fire Department, stated that on April 14, 1995, his office received notice from the FBI that, quote-unquote, terrorist activity may take place in the near future, and they were warned that individuals may, in fact, be moving into the city during that weekend. On April 14, 1995, McVeigh checked into the Dreamland Motel in Junction City, Kansas. Various people at the motel recall that this individual, who called himself Timothy McVeigh, was covered in tattoos, had glasses, and had an abundance of body hair and other striking physical features that do not match those of the real Timothy McVeigh. The owner of the motel, as well as members of their family, told the FBI and later reporters that McVeigh had parked two different Ryder trucks at the motel at different periods of time. The first of which was smaller and a faded, older-looking vehicle, while the second one was much larger and a newer model. An individual placed an order for Chinese food on April 15th, and according to the man who delivered it, the individual who was inside the motel room did not resemble Timothy McVeigh, Terry Nichols, or any of the other various John Doe number 2 suspects or sketches. On April 17th, a man entered Elliot's Body Shop, which was just a few miles down the road from the Dreamland motel and rented a Ryder truck. This individual gave their name as Bob Kling. Various people have reported that this Bob individual came into the office sometimes by himself, but other accounts state that there were one to two other individuals with them at the time that they rented this truck. This is important as it was later determined that this Bob Kling was in fact Timothy McVeigh. At around 5 a.m. on April 18th, 1995, McVeigh is known to have left the Dreamland Motel, driving the larger and newer of the two Ryder trucks from the motel, and McVeigh later claimed that he and Terry Nichols had spent the day building the bomb in the back of the truck, after which he drove the Ryder from Kansas to Oklahoma, stopping at some point along the way in a gravel parking lot before moving on to a motel. This is interesting as McVeigh did not bring the Ryder truck with him. He, in fact, left it in this gravel lot before walking to the motel, where he stayed until early the next morning. Things continued to get further muddied from this point on, as witnesses placed McVeigh and two other individuals at a restaurant in Perry, Oklahoma, around 7:30 p.m. on the night of April 18th. Other individuals saw them actually at a McDonald's in Oklahoma City, before McVeigh and another person unknown was seen at a convenience store around 9:30 p.m. before further showing up at this same convenience store around midnight. Both of these were in Oklahoma City. Now, when pressed about this period of time during which McVeigh was seen at various restaurants in and around Oklahoma City, he told his defense team, quote unquote, maybe the Ryder truck was in a government warehouse being loaded with explosives. According to the conspiracy theory narrative, while McVeigh was being seen all around town during this period of time, an unknown individual by the name of Poindexter and Richard Guthrie, who, if you'll remember, was a member of the ARA who supposedly hung himself in a prison cell in 1996, actually completed the construction of the bomb. This piece actually makes some bit of sense, as from everything that I know of the bomb that was constructed to go off at the Murrah building, it would have been next to impossible for McVeigh to drive hundreds of miles with this explosive in the back of the truck, as it was extremely volatile, and it has been said that even the slightest jolt could have set it off. It's much more realistic to think that it was driven a short period or a short distance before being set outside of the Murrah building. However, there are some people who insist that the bomb that went off the following morning was not, in fact, a fertilizer bomb, but some other type of explosive. Furthering the conspiracy angle, it has been stated by an individual who claimed to have been a cellmate of Timothy McVeigh after his arrest. After the bomb was constructed, Guthrie and a fake truck bomb were dropped off at a motel near Oklahoma City, after which McVeigh and this individual by the name who is named as Poindexter made their way to a warehouse in Oklahoma City, where the major and an individual known only by the name of Roberto met with the two of them, at which time Poindexter was killed and his body was dropped into the back of the Ryder truck, which was used in the bombing. This next bit of information is very interesting. The ATF was not present in the building on the day of the bombing. Now, they had offices inside of the building, and after the bombing took place, members of the ATF were seen looking through the rubble, not for bodies, but actually for files and other pieces of information pertaining to cases. And when questioned about this, they were told that it was a restricted area and that the individuals who had seen them needed to leave. After which point, the ATF agents either took the files that they found and spirited them away, or else destroyed them on the spot. Why is this interesting? Well, an ATF agent, after the bombing, told a group of reporters that the ATF had been involved in an ongoing sensitive sting operation, and that because of this sting operation, the Murrah building was under very heavy surveillance. This surveillance, however, was discontinued around 6 a.m. on the morning of April 19th. Now, this ATF spokesman later retracted this statement. However, multiple witnesses have come forward to state that they saw bomb disposal units in various parts of the city around the Murrah building prior to the bomb going off. And in fact, members of the Oklahoma City Bomb Squad later confirmed that they had in fact searched the federal courthouse looking for a bomb on the morning of the explosion. Starting at a roughly 7 a.m., people throughout Oklahoma City started to see Timothy McVeigh, sometimes by himself, oftentimes accompanied by numerous other unknown individuals, throughout the city. In each instance, McVeigh was seen driving a different vehicle. At roughly 8:32 Central Standard Time, an individual made a phone call to the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., claiming that the Murrah building in Oklahoma had just been bombed. When pressed as to how they knew this information, the individual stated that they were standing across the street and had just witnessed it, after which point the phone call was severed. Half an hour later, the bomb inside of the Ryder truck went off. This was at 9:02 a.m. We discussed it in the first episode, so I'm not going to get into this part too heavily. Multiple witnesses saw Timothy McVeigh or other suspicious-looking individuals immediately after the bombing took place all throughout Oklahoma City. Sometimes on foot, at other periods driving vehicles. But the important thing is that most of the time that McVeigh was seen after the bombing, numerous people were seen with him. As we know, about an hour to 90 minutes after the bombing took place, McVeigh was arrested in Perry, Oklahoma. On April 21st, 1995, McVeigh was delivered to Tinker Air Force Base via a black helicopter, where he would remain in an isolation cell until the next evening when he was arraigned at 8:30 p.m. During his time in this isolation cell, two public defenders came to see Timothy McVeigh, and both of them described him as eerily calm and completely unashamed of what he had done. Both stated that McVeigh almost gleefully admitted his guilt in the bombing. Something interesting in this period of time is that apparently McVeigh initially confessed to these two defense attorneys that he was in fact an agent of the federal government who had discovered a bombing plot and had been instructed by his handlers to embed himself within it. McVeigh is also said to have told these defense attorneys that the bomb he had been supplied with had only been supposed to blow out a few windows. However, he suspected that he had been double-crossed, as the bomb obviously caused massive amounts of damage and was not the bomb that they believed he had been originally supplied with. A few weeks after this meeting with his defense attorneys, McVeigh was given new attorneys, as the original group of them requested to be removed from the case. According to this new attorney, they had a 10-hour-long discussion during which McVeigh confessed to being the bomber and his guilt in it. When pressed on the idea that there was another individual, the unknown John Doe number 2, McVeigh denied that any such person actually existed. The last thing we're really going to look at this week is the idea how quickly the federal government went from talking and publicly stating that there were other individuals who were suspects in this bombing, specifically the John Doe number 2. This was reported everywhere for a few days, but very quickly and almost without even acknowledging the idea that another person had initially been suspected in the bombing, the federal government came out and stated, no, there was nobody else in Oklahoma City on the day of the bombing. Timothy McVeigh was the only one present, and now that we have him in custody, we are closing that aspect of the case. That is curious in that eventually a grand jury was going to be convened in Oklahoma City that included the mayor of Oklahoma City and numerous other individuals. The reason that this grand jury was convened was really nobody who lived in Oklahoma City believed that McVeigh and Terry Nichols had acted alone. They believed that there was a conspiracy in this, and enough evidence was found during this grand jury for the grand jury to conclude that, yes, in fact, other persons unknown had, in fact, been involved in the bombing plot, and that there was a conspiracy on the part of the United States government to cover this fact up. There are numerous reasons why the federal government may have done this. One train of thought holds that, again, we've discussed it many times, McVeigh was actually working for the feds, and that he either went rogue or that the operation that he was involved with got away from the federal government. That would explain why they were so quick to close the door on the idea of other people being involved. Another theory is that the government closed the door on the idea that there were others involved in it because they feared that should that information come out and the names of these individuals be released, people that they had working on the inside, be it actual agents or informants, might be compromised. And that could possibly hold water, as we know that during this period of time, the white power movement within the United States was heavily compromised by various intelligence forces of the United States, be they agents or informants. So that very well could be the reason that McVeigh ended up taking the fall all by himself, as it were. So, what ended up happening to Timothy McVeigh? On June 2nd of 1997, McVeigh was found guilty on 11 counts and would go on to receive a death sentence. Eventually, McVeigh would be transferred to USB Terre Haute, which is in Terre Haute, Indiana. This was in 1999. and McVeigh ended up dropping the remainder of his appeals. On January 10, 2001, the FBI turned over documents of evidence that had been withheld from McVeigh's attorneys, and because of this, McVeigh's execution, which had been scheduled to take place on the 16th, was stayed for an entire month. Eventually, McVeigh's execution date was rescheduled for June 11th. As his final statement, McVeigh directed people to read the phone Invictus by William Ernest Henley. Being led to the execution chamber, McVeigh refused to provide any last words. McVeigh was executed at 7:14 a.m. on June 11th, 2001. One thing that I want to point out here is that members and victims of the Oklahoma City bombing were able to watch Timothy McVeigh's execution on a closed-circuit television, and I know individuals who witnessed it as they had family members who were inside the Murrah Building on the day of the execution, and they have all stated that McVeigh went to his death with a resigned calmness about him, as though he had been expecting and awaiting this day to come for many years. As for Terry Nichols, he has continued to speak publicly when given an opportunity from his prison cell, where he will spend the remainder of his natural life. In doing so, he continues to fuel the conspiracy theories that Timothy McVeigh did not act alone. This is going to be the absolute last episode on Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City bombing, as there is other information out there, some of it pertinent to the case, but I've covered so much of it throughout my coverage of this particular story that it would just be redundancy. At this point, I am going to offer my personal views on what happened. I do believe that there was a conspiracy to bomb the Murrah Building, and by conspiracy, I don't mean that Timothy McVeigh was a federal employee or an agent or an informant. What I mean is that I believe that McVeigh and Nichols were not alone in their actions leading up to and perpetrating the bombing on April 19th. I think multiple other individuals were involved in this, specifically members of the Aryan Republican Army, Richard Lee Guthrie being one of them. One of the reasons for this is that it was said by multiple individuals who knew Timothy McVeigh in the years and months leading up to the bombing, he was not a leader, he was a follower. He was one of those individuals who would carry out any task that was assigned to him to the best of his ability, but he did not possess the ability to lead others towards doing the things that he wanted them to do. I also think that Timothy McVeigh's plot to blow up the Murrah Building was known in advance by the federal government. They may not have known the specifics of it, but I believe that they had enough foreknowledge of it that they were able to get individuals who worked for the ATF and the FBI out of the building prior to the bombing, and that they learned of this information through their various informants in the white nationalist movement. I also believe that the federal government was so quick to drop the idea of a John Doe being involved, or multiple John Does being involved in the bombing plot, because of the fact that some of those individuals were more likely than not informants for the federal government, and they understood and realized that if it came out that people who were on the government's payroll or providing information to them were involved in this massive loss of human life, the federal government, given what had taken place at Waco and at Ruby Ridge, would never have been able to recover the trust of the general public. But more than that, at that point, the federal government legally would have been responsible for the bombing in some way, shape, or form. Furthering on that, though, the government did not want that information out there because they still had and continue to have informants within the alt-right who are giving them information, many of which had prior knowledge and passed this knowledge on to the federal government concerning the bombing. I do not believe that Timothy McVeigh was an agent for the intelligence agencies. I think he may have become delusioned to the fact that he had been, and this was the only way that he could grasp and comprehend the severe traumas that he had experienced both in the Gulf War and upon returning home when he washed out of Special Forces. I think in his mind, telling people the lie that he had was working for the intelligence department was the only way that he could face up to the shame that he had felt over not being able to cut it as a member of the Special Forces. There are people who are going to argue with me on that and say that, but you know, on his death certificate, it listed him as being a soldier and that he had a federal government credit card. The credit card has never been proven. The fact that he was listed as a soldier on his death certificate, that was the only job that Timothy McVeigh had during his life that was long-term. Every other job that he held was simply short-term, working either in factories or for security companies. He was in the military for years on end. And that is what he identified himself as. So there we have it in 8 parts, the story of the Oklahoma City bombing. If you want to find out more information on this particular story, and there is a lot more information on it, I didn't touch on all of it just because I was not going to sit here and do a 50-part series on this case. I honestly suggest that you seek out the book Aberration in the Heartland of the Real, The Secret Lives of Timothy McVeigh by Wendy S. Painting, Ph.D. Unlike many of the books you will find on this particular case, Miss Painting actually has footnotes with explanatory information at the end of every chapter. And in fact, if you get the Kindle version of that book and click on these footnotes, it will take you to the actual sources of the information, whether they be from a FOIA request, a book by somebody else, a paper somebody wrote, or a video with an individual speaking. It's an invaluable resource, and I highly encourage you to dive into it. Until next time and the next case, The Death Cast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. I encourage you also to go to your favorite podcasting app and leave a 5-star review for the show. Subscribe and share it on social media. Till next time, stay morbid.